You're listening to the Speech Uncensored podcast. This is the place we dive into all the particulars of communication, voice, swallow, and cognition with tangible applications to the world of medical speech and language pathology. You can expect something new and interesting each week with resources in specially curated show notes on speechuncensored.com. I have a special treat in store for you this week. The Speech Uncensored Fellow, Rebecca Brown, is joining me as co-host in today's episode. We're interviewing Michelle Dagon on swallowing challenges after cervical spinal cord injury from trauma or surgery. There is so much good stuff in this episode, I can't wait for you to soak it all in. My name is Leanne Porter. I'm your enthusiastic and inquisitive host, and I hope you're ready to get your nourish and flourish on.
Hi, everyone. My name is Rebecca Brown. I'm a speech-language pathologist in Texas, and I work with neonates, adults, and geriatric patients in the acute care setting. I am Leanne Porter's fellow in the Speech Uncensored podcast for the spring semester, and I'm so grateful that she's letting me co-host this episode with her today, because today we have Michelle Dagon with us, and she is going to be talking to us about swallowing challenges after a cervical spinal cord injury. And I'm so excited to hear from her. I fangirl over her regularly. She knows her stuff, and I'm going to let her introduce herself. And I can't wait to see what this episode has in store and to learn from her.
All right. Thank you so much, Rebecca. So my name's Michelle Dagon. I'm a speech pathologist. I have multiple titles in my job role at this point. So I'm the research education coordinator for speech pathology for the Memorial Hermann Healthcare System in Houston. And then specifically, I treat clinically, so I'm a speech-language pathologist part of the day. And then the other part of the day, I'm a therapy education resource specialist. And I am the ASHA CEU provider for my healthcare system, and I coordinate bringing in presenters and credentialing courses. And I also lecture at a lot of those courses. And that's my work side of life. And then in the field of speech pathology, I really just enjoy lecturing across the country. I have been practicing for 23 years. It doesn't seem like it's been 23 years at all. I feel like it's been like five, but we age whether we want to or not. I am board certified in swallowing and swallowing disorders, and I have had that credential since 2007.
Awesome. Well, welcome, Michelle. We are so glad to have you. I'm really excited for this. I think that the topic that you picked today is so good, because managing dysphagia after cervical spinal cord injury or surgery can get hairy. Like, sometimes it doesn't seem like there's like really clear direction in the literature on like how to manage it, what to do. So I'm really excited about you kind of like laying the foundation for us about like what it is, what's out there, what we know, and going from there. All right.
Yay. So I'd just like to start with talking about how, you know, although we are the swallowing experts on the case after a cervical spinal cord injury, you know, the main issue isn't just dysphagia, it's adequate nutrition. It's being able to get your medications in. And for a lot of these patients, it's been life-altering and changing, because now they have significant motor impairments and sensory impairments that they may or may not have been anticipating prior to the injury or surgery that occurred. So just kind of start off there with the acute incidence of dysphagia in this group. It's pretty high. Postoperatively, in the first 5 days, it's around 71 to 80% of cases. And so that is a really high number. Interestingly enough, a lot of these patients are discharged home within 24 to 48 hours of surgery if it's an elective procedure, as opposed to, say, a traumatic cervical spinal cord injury where they're more likely to remain hospitalized. So some of those groups are just being sent home, and then they lose massive amounts of weight and don't really know what direction to go in. So that's a pretty big concern. And just to kind of give you a personal aside, you know, my sister is a registered dietitian on a spinal cord injury team at the VA. So we discuss this topic a lot about how, you know, where is nutrition and where is dysphagia and how does this all come together? So that's just a personal thing. And if you look in the literature, the numbers are kind of all over the place, because these publications go back about 20 or 30 years. And it kind of really depends on how you define dysphagia. And pretty much in the literature after a spinal cord injury or surgery, nobody's defining dysphagia the way we do. They're not doing an instrumental swallow study. They're just saying, did the patient say they could swallow or couldn't swallow? Did they go home eating? Did they not go home eating? And it's very vague shades of gray. So I don't really think we have a good idea of if they have dysphagia, what does that dysphagia actually look like? And obviously the higher up the cervical spinal cord injury, your need for nutrition will be lower also. So I want you to think about that. If you laid in bed with the flu for a couple weeks, you probably wouldn't be eating very much. You'd be having some soup and, you know, sipping on some fluids. And so these patients are kind of in that same situation. They're trying to get neuro recovery and get their functioning back. But at the same time, they're not very mobile. They're not very active. And so they are not having as high of a caloric need or caloric drive as they would have before the surgery or the injury. So just to kind of go through all the different things that could cause dysphagia in a cervical spinal cord injury patient, and they are lengthy. The actual injury itself, depending on how it displaced the spinal cord, whether they had a co-occurring vertebral artery injury. So if you get hit hard enough at the back of the neck where your vertebral arteries run, that can cause an occlusion or a dissection. There's different grades of those injuries. Most of the time, those heal on their own, or the physician prescribes a nice little blood thinner and things all work out. Every now and then, that is a recipe for disaster. I think the saddest case with the poorest outcomes is the cervical spinal cord injury patient who has a brainstem trauma or brainstem stroke. I have had several in my career, and I can tell you that none of them have panned nicely. The actual neck stabilization hardware, both the internal hardware that the physician places or the external hardware that is like the collars, which we'll talk about in a minute, can cause some difficulty with swallowing. You can have a vocal cord injury when they intubate you, especially if they intubate you in the field, or you can have an injury as a result of the operative procedure to do the anterior cervical discectomy infusion, which can cause a recurrent laryngeal nerve injury or a superior laryngeal nerve injury. And but I will say, I don't think we've ever, like, as a profession, really looked at the superior laryngeal nerve injury incidents. The recurrent one, I mean, we obviously see that one, but I can only vividly remember one very clear-cut superior laryngeal nerve injury. I'm not saying it doesn't happen all more frequently than that, but I just distinctly remember that case. Then these patients are more likely sometimes to have a trach in place, and then all the things that go along with that, like, you know, your, you know, infections at the trach site, your stenosis, your tracheomalacia, your laryngomalacia, all those kinds of things. They're typically on a lot of medications, which we'll talk about in a minute. We got the reduced respiratory drive from if it's a cervical spinal cord injury in which you actually are paralyzed versus just an ACDF in which you don't have a cord injury, which is very different. I mainly work with the patients who have become paralyzed as a result of either the surgery itself was supposed to be very straightforward and went very wrong, or they were a traumatic injury. So that's my group more than the, oh, I had an ACDF and I walked out of the hospital, but I can't swallow. But that group exists too, I realize. And then do they have baseline osteophytes? I would argue that many of these patients, especially when they're elderly, have baseline osteophytes, which confound the clinical picture. Then they have some swelling in that retropharyngeal space, which I'll show you, I think, an image of in a minute. But even though this is a podcast, you can go look at the notes. I would say that age confounds every single one of these things. So the older you are, the messier this gets and just makes it more complicated. And so just to kind of be aware, I think that the internal hardware that physicians place varies by city and location of the country in which you're in. So when I first started in my career, we were very into putting in a lot of cages. I almost never see a cage internally placed anymore. And if anybody wants to know what that looks like, it really does look like a cage taking up the space of the spinal cord. And it's used to give depth and space to where the cord would have been if they've had to completely usually resect it out of there. Plates are exactly what they sound like. They are like metal plates that are in the body, and they are literally screwed in with screws. Those screws can migrate. Those plates can migrate. Yes, I've seen that all go real wrong. And if you ever have to go in and remove said hardware, and redo it, the odds of dysphagia just goes through the roof. And it's really sad in that case. And then there's external hardware, which is, you know, when you see the patients with all the collars, you know, we got the Miami J and the Aspen, which are most common in the Houston area, but I'm sure other parts of the country use different collars. We almost never use a halo anymore, but that can still be a trend in parts of the country, depending on physician preference. I will say there was an interesting study done in South Africa where they put a bunch of 20-year-olds in some of these collars, and they had them do a swallow study pre and post. And nobody changed in terms of airway safety and efficiency, but everyone with the collar on triggered a later swallow. So it lends itself for you to think, well, if you're wearing a collar and it is enough of a small timing change, a big difference when someone's maybe perhaps older versus someone who's perhaps younger and can overcome that change. So it's just food for thought. Then in the next part of the resources, I'll just kind of describe this. So there's a lot of medications that wreak havoc on our swallowing function. And there was a wonderful little book that was published many years ago in our field called Drugs and Dysphagia. And so what I did as a fun project was list the top medications that are prescribed to patients post-spinal cord injury. And then I made a chart and tried to figure out like, what were some of the side effects from taking those medications? And I don't know if people ever bothered to read the internal literature on pharmacy medications when they take them, but I do. But, you know, I will give you another side note. My father is a pharmacist, retired, and he was on the spinal cord injury team. So do you see the trend here that my whole family and I are very interested in spinal cord injury? So that, I find that very interesting that so many of the medications we give cause heartburn, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, GI pain, anorexia, taste alterations, and dry mouth. Like that's the first eight. And so when you think about that, you're like, well, no wonder my patient maybe doesn't want to eat, even if they could eat, because a lot of these patients, even when I clear them to eat, oftentimes don't have the best appetites. And so I just think that's food for thought. And besides treating a patient's swallowing, I have three goals in rehab. Get you back to your baseline diet, if at all possible. Get you talking and speaking as well as you can, as close to your baseline, in order to communicate your functional wants and needs. And the third one is, I'd like you to be able to direct your own care, verbally direct your own care. And part of directing your own care is advocating for your medical care and understanding what meds are they giving you. Are they all absolutely necessary? And can we ask polite questions of our physicians in what is really needed or not needed in the long-term course of treatment for some patients? So that's one of the reasons why I go over their meds with them. And so I think it just leads to a more holistic patient experience.
I love that, Michelle. I love that you go and you like sort through their meds with them, because I think that hits so many areas of importance. And I just love that, like, the third goal of your, like, trifecta is making them more in charge of their overall care, empowering them. That's our role as therapists, you know? That's what we're equipping them to do. And so I just love that you're giving us, like, really tangible insights on how, like, we can incorporate that into our practice, too.
Yes, yes.
I think I've heard you mention that Drugs and Dysphagia book before, too. I think it's
a great book. I mean, it was written in 06, and you have to take that with a grain of salt, because, you know, drugs are constantly evolving and being prescribed in new ways and in new methods. And I just like to also throw this out there. And the reason why I like the speech path and the patient to kind of like explore that, but in a way that's not taking over the role of the pharmacist or the physician, is that I don't know about you two, but do you have people have drug allergies and they have drug sensitivities? Okay, so when your doctor always asks you, what are you allergic to? Most people can list that off, but we're probably a lot more sensitive to some meds too, just kind of like you're sensitive to some food groups. And I think it's important for patients to try and figure out what that is for themselves, because some people really react to these medications and they don't know what's going on. We have to help them create that questioning mindset so that they can kind of build their own clinical picture.
Agreed.
I love it. I love it. I love it.
So I don't know how many people listening have ever actually watched an ACDF surgery. I don't think it's the one that most SLPs go watch. There are plenty of YouTube videos on this. I would encourage people who have the stomach for it to watch it, because it is an extremely invasive procedure, and it just looks wow. You are cutting a patient open from the side of their neck, and you are putting in clamps, and you are opening up the side of their spine in their throat region, and you are digging around to the front of the spine to add in hardware. And then you're praying to God they don't hit the recurrent laryngeal nerve. And to be on the physician side on this, they can't see the recurrent laryngeal nerve when they open all that up. And so, and their job is, you know, to just fix the spine and to try to do it as quickly as humanly possible, because you don't really want to be in that position for too long with all those things stretched out. And, you know, stretched out nerves, you know, is it paresis versus paralysis? And, that's another argument for another day, but it's a very intense medical procedure. And then think about the patient who's having the anterior surgery and then like 6 hours later having the posterior surgery, and they're being flipped on their back and then their front and then their side, and then they have vent tubing down them because they have to be intubated for that procedure. And it's not in any way a gentle surgical process. So
I have a question. So I saw a patient a few weeks ago in the hospital, and he was telling me that I guess he's had an ACDF in the past, and this time he fell and is requiring another spinal cord surgery. And the doctor was going to do a posterior because he was like, oh, I want to avoid, you know, damaging the swallow, affecting the swallow. Mm-hmm. And I've heard some people say that having both an ACDF and a posterior surgery can worsely impact the swallow function. Ooh. Has that been your experience, or?
Honestly, I usually get the group that's posterior only, anterior. Well, I've had, okay, I guess all three scenarios. I'm not going to say I haven't had all three scenarios. I think posterior alone is usually the best outcome for swallowing. And anterior alone, if they don't have osteophytes that they tried to like put plates over osteophytes and change the layout of the posterior pharyngeal wall, like it, that is a big problem if there's osteophytes. I'm trying to think of the people who have both. Usually those are my, you know, they're quadriplegics already for me. So I haven't necessarily noticed, but it would be interesting to kind of, I do find this though, if you have an ACDF and then you fall later in life, the odds are that, you know, they basically fused you. And if you were fused at any one point and then I flopped you over, you're more likely to break on either side of where they fused you in your next fall. Or okay. Think about it. What, and they use that phrase I used to say, what was it? What happens at your hips happens at your lips. Whatever that phrase was, we used to say all the time. So if you break your upper neck, or you have repair, regular surgery, not traumatic for your upper neck, and you fall, sometimes the low back can't handle the pressure that's changed in the tension of the spinal cord. Because, you know, the spinal cord is supposed to be really fluid and it's supposed to be bendable, even though we don't bend as much as we age. But yeah, I've seen more people who've like fallen after they've had an initial normal planned procedure and then had to be fused even more levels. And that's when it gets more complicated.
Hmm. Yeah. Have you seen any infections like around those surgical sites? I had a patient who had an infection around it, and it's like, he had this huge like retropharyngeal abscess. Yes. And it was like puffed out. It was bad.
Yes. I had a patient who actually became a mild anoxic BI because he had the elective procedure, and then his wife was sitting next to him in the hospital, and she started noticing this bleeding profusely out his trach site and couldn't get the medical team there in time. And apparently that whole space had filled with blood and it cut off his air supply. I don't know for how many minutes, but
no,
you know, he ended up presenting very unusual compared to my other patients because he wasn't paralyzed, but he was spastic. He had mild ataxic speech. He had severe to profound dysphagia. And it's just an interesting clinical picture because, yeah, I have seen it. But from an infection standpoint, I've rarely found an initial infection because usually I get them so acutely, right? And if there's swelling there, everyone doesn't assume it's an infection. They assume that it's just postoperative swelling. I don't know that they would delineate it as being an infection until the white blood cell count is rising. And then when the white blood cell count is it rising because they now have the UTI and they now have the pneumonia, they now have all these other things going on. And like, you know, it's like searching for the infection. So I would say I have that less frequently, but I have had one outpatient who came in who'd had a ACDF maybe like 5 years before, and he was in his mid-40s. And the way the hardware put pressure at C7 and the PES caused a cricofaringeal bar because he was swallowing so hard to push food through the pharynx that he had completely changed his pharyngeal pressures and given himself a cricofaringeal bar. So I was like, well, even if they fix the cricofaringeal bar, the hardware is still there. He's now spent 5 years learning a disordered swallow pattern. And I don't know that we're going to fix that necessarily. So that was kind of an interesting case.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. Sorry. I don't want to.
That's okay.
Go on down.
I have lots of stories. that's what makes it so interesting. The complications of the ACDF or the anterior cervical discectomy infusion, we kind of already reviewed some of them, but you know, it's, you know, reflux, hoarseness, vocal fatigue. There can be the hematoma you just mentioned in infection. There can be poor positioning due to the neck collars. I find those neck collars to be a real challenge because at our hospital, because I'm an inpatient rehab, we move people all the time in every direction. You know, we're swinging them into their chair. We're swinging them here. We're doing all these things with them. And so we kind of have a hard and fast rule, unless a surgeon has said otherwise, that you have to wear that collar for 12 weeks once you get to me. And that's just to provide neck stability during all the things we do. Now, sometimes we force those patients to sleep with it on, and sometimes we're like, okay, you can have a little bit of rest while you're sleeping or laying in the bed and no one's moving you. But I also find that these patients, because of their higher up injury, are prone to kind of like sagging. And when they sag, their upper chest comes forward and their head automatically tilts back. So they're kind of like hyperextended. And I've noticed this on several patients, and it's just food for thought when you do an instrumental swallow study or even the clinical bedside. Make sure you get these patients into as neutral a spine as you can, because if you are slightly hyperextended and you have hardware in your throat, you've just created the perfect slide into the airway. I mean, it just looks like an exact slide. Everything will just slide into the airway. And so really trying to educate that maybe that's the patient that needs one pillow upper right behind the upper part of their head to just try and get them as in perfect alignment as possible. Because their posture is just really off the collar. They're trying to get away from the collar. They don't want it rubbing on their chin, so they're lifting their chin away from it. They're kind of, and then you do a swallow study and everyone makes them NPO. And then the next time I do a swallow study on them, I'm like, well, how about we just try head neutral? And then suddenly they swallow beautifully. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we kept somebody NPO all this time that really could have swallowed if it was as simple as a pillow or a rolled up towel. So really, really check that out. And especially also with fees, because fees is not always my primary instrumental on this group, but I can explain why later. For the scope, they also try to run away from the scope as well. So they try to put themselves again into hyperextension. So that's another concern. So at the bedside, you know, in acute care, these patients obviously have a lot of swelling. They're probably still pretty lethargic from anesthesia coming out of it and that sort of thing. So, you know, I haven't done acute care in a while. So that's not my current wheelhouse. But when they get to rehab, I usually get them, if all things went well in acute care. I usually get them within 7 to 10 days of their initial procedure. If acute care involved like a polytrauma situation, I might not get you for 4 to 6 weeks. It really kind of depends on all what happened there. I do find that some physicians, neurosurgeons are pretty resistant to consulting speech pathology. So a lot of these patients end up with trachs and pegs early on in their medical course. And when they get to rehab, well, lo and behold, they probably didn't need either of those things. But we have some rules and regulations that for peg tube safety, you can't remove it until week 6 in our facility to allow for complete healing of the internal site because if you pull it too soon, they can internally bleed and nobody wants that. So that's kind of our hard and fast rule. For speech paths who are interested in learning about ASIA scoring, I encourage that. They have, that's available to you and you can take it. It's the American Spinal Cord Injury Association has a scoring system primarily used by PM&R physicians, physical therapists, occupational therapists. And I think that the ASIA score can tell you a little bit about what you're going to see on your swallow eval. That's why I like it. If I see anything C4 and above, I'm concerned about coordinating breathing with swallowing more so. Not to say that couldn't happen at a different level, but I just always ask the patient to shrug their shoulders. I try to find their ASIA score to find out if it's complete spinal cord injury or an incomplete. A complete spinal cord injury would be considered an ASIA A. Incompletes are B, C, D. I never see an E. An E is really rare. And then, so that kind of gives you an idea they might have a chance of some improvement because there is some connectivity through the spinal cord. I'm very much a stickler for doing the oral mech exam, and I take joys in torturing residents who tell me that cranial nerves 2 through 12 are grossly intact in this particular population. Because I'm like, really? You heard them speak? You heard them speak on the vent with no PMV? Really? That's how you came up with that? I also torture my ENT on that one too, because he has a form he just fills in and he's wrong. That's my issue with forms. We shouldn't have forms that fill things in. So make sure you look at the whole patient. When I get these patients, I look at the suction canister behind them on the wall. What color are the secretions? Are they completely on a vent? Are they off the vent? Are they on the vent, but look like they have the potential to get off the vent? And usually it's respiratory therapy who's helping me kind of make that determination based on some measurements they're taking. But usually when I first get them, they're usually on oxygen and their cuff is inflated. So I'm kind of starting at ground zero, trying to get the airway open and that sort of thing before we tackle swallowing. I almost never give a patient PO the first time I meet them in my inpatient rehab. That's pretty much a no for me. Can't tell you how many of these patients, I like to play the game of what will you see on a swallow study before I take a patient down to the swallow study. And I'd say that my current success rate at 23 years in is about 80%. And it's the patient that makes you think they look beautiful, that it's all kinds of wrong. And it's the ones that look all kinds of wrong on the outside that are sometimes all kinds of right on the inside. So I just don't think I have the luxury of working in a facility where I have everything at my fingertips. So I don't see why I wouldn't do instrumental swallow studies. And my physicians 100% support that. So I realize I live in a slightly ideal world. And for people who don't, there are, you know, this group is significantly more likely to have the swelling in the throat, so they're more likely to have the residue. If there's a voice change, you can already suspect that one of the vocal cords isn't working completely. Even, you know, I have personal friends who've had ACDFs electively, and every single one of them had difficulty swallowing the first 6 months. So keep that in mind as kind of the standard. They're not going to go eat a hamburger, and that is just not what they're going to do right off the bat, even though that's what they would all like to do. I guess this goes to my bias. We all have a bias, right? And so I started in my career with modified barium swallows because I graduated a long time ago and FEES was in its infancy when I started practicing. And then I learned FEES probably a decade ago. So in this patient population, I kind of tried to break it up into couple things. If you have what I assume is a pretty obvious vocal fold pathology and or you appear to be drowning in your secretions, I lean towards the FEES exam as your first exam. But I really like to see how the hardware plays out in interacting with your oral, pharyngeal, and esophageal phases. And I can't really see that on a fees, because on a fees, you just look like you are a tiny, narrow little pathway that I can barely see the epiglottis at the other end of sometimes. And I can't sometimes ever see the vocal folds. So then I feel like I've wasted my time scheduling the procedure and I didn't get the diagnostic information I needed out of it. So in a perfect world, I prefer to do the modified first and then do follow-up fees exams. That's my blended world. That's kind of how I like to do it. Some options in this group that, you know, I think will be in our future are pharyngeal manometry for looking at the pressures, because I really, really believe that it is not necessarily a strength problem these patients have after these cervical spinal cord injuries. I feel like it's a pressure problem they have. And I think we need more research on that. But just the way the bolus will like not move or will move in a retrograde manner, it just leads me to believe that the pressure systems are all off and they're fighting it so hard. And if they're on the vent, you hear them fighting it because there's like this back pressure going beep, beep while they try to like swallow through it. And you're like, yeah, something pressure wise is happening there. There have been instances when I've had to recommend upper GIs and gastric emptying studies because this group, any injury at T6, above T6 will automatically slow gastric emptying and will impact lower esophageal sphincter opening. And some of these patients also have upper esophageal sphincter issues as well. But just think that if their injury is high up and they've lost muscle tone below it and they've lost innervation of the nervous system below it, then they are obviously more likely going to have trouble operating any sphincter below there. I mean, that's why the Asia exam includes the anal sphincter test, because that is one of the sphincters that is also impacted. So it's hard to go to the bathroom. It's hard to have bowel movements. It's hard to, you know, void urine. Anything that runs on a sphincter system has been impacted by the nature of the injury. And so that's something to keep in mind, because a lot of these patients, if we give them a bunch of medications and we crush them, I question where those crushed meds end up. I really do. Like, are they hanging out in the esophagus, never really getting anywhere? Also, for these same reasons, when these patients are put on tube feedings, we give what we would consider, you know, this prescribed tube feeding based on ideal body weight and all of these kinds of things. But how much is too much for somebody who hasn't been eating for a while? Are we overfilling them and then it pushes back through that lower esophageal sphincter into their esophagus and then they're refluxing? And then the speech pathologist gets blamed for aspiration pneumonia when really it was aspiration pneumonitis, but nobody tested to see which one was really which one. Mm-hmm. My vote is that it's aspiration pneumonitis more often than the other. Really, I'm pro for trying to get these patients to wear the Pasimir speaking valve, but I would like to say that not all patients can wear a Pasimir speaking valve. And I like to put that out there because I get this feeling that across the country, there's this grand plan in speech pathology where we must do the speaking valve before we move forward with oral intake. And considering I've had patients who've never successfully worn the PMV but have a gorgeous functional swallow on an instrumental swallow eval, you would have kept a patient MPO their entire life because you needed a PMV to go on. And I need people to kind of let go of some of their rigid rules about what may be beneficial for a patient and may not. I'm not saying that we don't want them to do that. I'm not saying that obviously subglottic air pressure is a great thing to have. It reduces the risk of aspiration and, you know, that sort of thing. But at the same time, I really think that you can try a study with and without a PMV. You can see what works for your particular patient. I don't know if you guys have noticed that. Like, I find that the C1 Asia A's really struggle with wearing the Pasimir speaking valve. Like, really, really struggle.
Yes. I think that in general, people don't understand that some patients are just not appropriate for the speaking valve. Even patients who are not in this population that have swelling that is causing airway obstruction will get consulted on, please put this valve on this patient that I trached because they have a huge mass in their pharynx and now they need this trach to breathe. Yeah. And you're like, I can't, I'm so sorry. I want to, but, and then I've read recent literature that doesn't necessarily say that a patient swallows any better with the valve than without the valve. And like in my professional experience, like it has helped, but typically it's not like a drastic help.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it helps, but it's not like day and night difference like you think it's going to be. I don't know, but that's just my experience. I know that it's better when you can, but it's not appropriate for everyone.
It's not. And I have one interesting story in case this happens to anybody. I had a patient who was a spinal cord, and we got to the point where it was, we had downsized the trach from like an 8 to, I guess we'd gotten down to like a 4. And the stoma would not heal around the tracheostomy tube. But he could wear the speaking valve. But what was the point if half the air was coming out below around the trach stoma site? So, but in his case, because he couldn't get the subglottic air pressure, he aspirated on every single swallow. And I watched it instrumentally. Like, I was like, okay. So then I was like, well, how can I restore subglottic air pressure if it's just, it's not healing yet? So I rolled up some gauze and I put gentle pressure underneath the trach site where the gap was. And as long as I gently held it like a V around the trach, he swallowed and he never once aspirated. So for that patient, he really did need the subglottic air pressure. And I had to post photos around his bed and train everyone that this is the only way you can feed this patient, which was a really bizarre recommendation, but apparently it worked. You know, I think that we are great problem solvers in our field and that our job is to try and figure out things that are a little bit outside the box, because I promise that the literature didn't come up with that one. That would have been a one-off. They'd been like, what? And I guess kind of coming back around to nutrition and hydration, you know, we're asking our patients to participate in rehab. We're asking our patients to participate in dysphagia exercises. And it's kind of hard to participate in anything if you don't have adequate nutrition and hydration. But you can't have adequate hydration and nutrition if you have dysphagia. So there's this, you know, which came first and how can we kind of, you know, cover our grounds. And so for a lot of my patients, I do kind of a, if I let them start eating and I really don't trust that they can eat enough, I have them getting their tube feeds Q4 hours in the middle of the night while they're sleeping. And then I send them 3 trays of food during the day. And we just try to do what we can to kind of build up an appetite and then like reduce the evening tube feeds as they can take more orally during the day. So we kind of create a hodgepodge situation, because you have to remember in the group that has a spinal cord injury, especially if they're still hospitalized, a prolonged hospitalization, they're at extremely high risk of skin breakdown. They need a lot of protein in order to facilitate neuro recovery of the spinal cord. And if we just keep sending pureed trays, because that's what goes down, we are going to be sending them lots of carbs and almost and very little protein. And so kind of keep that in the back of your mind. Like if the patient has to choose between the protein shake and the mashed potatoes, like, can you push the protein shake first? If that's, you know, something that they can safely consume, because it's also going to help with their, with either healing a wound, preventing a wound and that sort of thing. And I think that's really an important thing to, we have to collaborate with our dietitian colleagues on that one. And then, you know, we have the, are they being fed by others? Are they being fed? Are they able to feed themselves? And a lot of this group can't, but immediately if I have a C5 quadriplegic and I know that they can get hand to mouth motion, we get OT to put U cuffs on them right away. We get them self-feeding and we put them in slings and we suspend their elbows in the air above their bed and we try to have them start self-feeding. And I think that the sooner you get people self-feeding, it's A, motivating, and B, takes some caregiver burden away and helps address some of the nutrition concerns. You know, just consulting your OT friends for different kinds of adaptive equipment that can be used to promote self-feeding. I would say with the prevertebral swelling that I see, many of my patients actually drink, sometimes can drink like thin and nectar thick liquids before they can drink, before they can take solids because of the high level of residue. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, the MBS-IMP asks you to do thin by spoon and then thin by cup sip. And I'm going to be honest that I deviate from the MBS-IMP in this particular patient population. There's no sense in me giving them a cup sip of liquid if that the person that's going to give them the cup sip is going to drown them in the cup sip. So we just skip to straw drinking. you either drink liquids by spoon with me or you drink liquids by straw. And I really don't have middle ground when you're a high cervical spinal cord quadriplegic patient, because I just don't trust staff. I just don't trust people. And so I always test straws with everything with this group.
That's really insightful. I'm really glad you brought that up, because you're absolutely right. We're not going to go around and train every nurse or every caregiver for every patient. Here's how you give just the tiniest little amount by cup, you know, like, no, it's not going to work.
And no one's going to do it. And it's not. So you have to drink from straws. And I've tried the Prevail cup, but in this group, it just really doesn't. I mean, again, it doesn't work. They can't hold it. And what's a 5 ml, or I can even do a 10 ml spoon. So I just get the larger spoon if you think they can have a larger spoon set. So that's how I do it. I do think it's important the longer a patient has a cervical spinal cord injury and they're quadriplegic and this is going to be a lifelong injury for them, that it would be important if they could go figure out how many calories are they really burning post-injury, because I feel that we always want to overfeed these patients. And so overfeeding leads to being uncomfortable. And if you overfeed, then the expectation's different. Like when we send patients a tray of food in the hospital, you know, what I put on my tray and what you put on your tray, I don't know. Like sometimes that tray has like 12 different items on it. And I eat 2 things for breakfast and I might eat 4 things for lunch. And sometimes I think they send more so that the patient has more choice, which is great. But then are you judging whether they consumed enough food based on the 12 items or 2 items? And like, what should we be judging that off of? And I'm not an expert on that. So I really think that we should maybe find ways to measure that. There are some, you know, formulas in general that dietitians try and use, but some of those formulas are over 100 years old, y'all. Do you think that the human body has changed in 100 years?
I'm thinking so. And how we use energy has changed from 100 years ago. And the type of ways that we get our nutrition and our calories has changed from what was available 100 years ago.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, I also have to caution, sometimes, you know, when you're a high quadriplegic, and we have phased admissions at my rehab, so you can come and then you go home for a while and then you come back when you have new rehab goals. And sometimes between admissions, I've had patients gain 50 pounds. So, you know, if food is one of your last is the only pleasure you have left after a high cervical spinal cord injury, you really are also at risk for overgaining weight. And so we have to do a lot of counseling on that, because then you can't do maybe transfers, or maybe you can't be more independent with your rehab goals because you now weigh so much, you can't pick your own body up. And in that case, it would be more positive for you to be more closer to your ideal body weight, you know, which is an issue. I just think it's important to kind of like look at nutrition holistically and think about the kinds of foods that we're offering the patients, how nutritionally dense they are. Like my running joke is that we give the low fat yogurt that's 90 calories Yoplait on our patient's tray on spinal cord. And I'm like, yeah, what's wrong with the high protein Greek yogurt? I mean, like, really? I mean, if it takes a lot of effort to swallow 4 ounces, would you rather swallow 4 ounces of something that actually has like protein and calories in it that does something for you? Or do you want to give them the diet yogurt? Because in their mind, they buy the yogurt for the stroke population. So you have to think about like, which was probably heart healthy and maybe was overweight, and that contributed to their like need to be in the hospital. And so I just kind of find that interesting, like, you know, less swallows, more nutrition might be better.
Yeah, I'm on board with that.
I think I put a couple things in here just for treatment options. So people are always asking me, well, how would you treat a cervical spinal cord injury patient? And it depends on a whole host of factors, but obviously increasing respiratory drive can improve their ability to handle the apneic phase of the swallow. So, and it can, you know, it leads to improved voice and a couple of other things. So that's a win-win across the board. And then I'm a big fan of the McNeil Dysphagia Therapy Program. I try to follow it. Sometimes I have to take a little detour on it, but for the most part, try really hard to follow it. And I've seen a lot of really good outcomes using it in this group, because doing the isolated exercises I don't find helps this group very much, because if it is edema, are you exercising on top of edema? Because I don't know what that's supposed to do for anybody. That's like if you have a swollen ankle and then I ask you to still do like leg lifts. I mean, is it doing anything for you? I mean, I don't know. And I feel like some people just feel this pressure to keep treating the patient because they obviously have dysphagia. But sometimes I'm like, you're just going to have to put them on medical hold for a little bit. I mean, is okay. Another common thing, you know, medically, you know, people will say, well, can the physician prescribe steroids? Well, and I don't know how people are familiar with this, but steroid use can actually reduce fusion of the hardware to the bone. And so in this group, you don't necessarily want to administer steroids. You might just need to let time take its time and not try to force that. Because if you give a steroid, you have to remember it's going to do the whole body. It's not going to just do the prevertebral swelling unless you're going to inject that with a needle, and that's a whole other scenario. So, you know, I try to get them swallowing something, anything, even if it has to be dietary restrictions, because, you know, swallowing is great therapy for swallowing. And that's pretty much it. And you can track your outcomes using a variety of outcome measures, because I do think that we make some headway. And I think that the EAT10 is probably a really powerful tool in this particular group. I don't necessarily use it in my brain injury group, but in this, yeah. Because they can tell you so much more about how uncomfortable it is to eat, or can they take their meds or not take their meds. And so I really find that that one's really useful in this particular population.
I love the EAT10. When I work in outpatient, like everyone who comes in, I'm like, here's an EAT10, here's an EAT10. You're all taking the EAT10.
Yeah, I really like it. I think it's hard to use it in the acute setting because I feel like people are like not awake, and I'm like,
that's true.
You know, like maybe you should wake up and then we can swallow something. So I do see alert people every now and then, though. I do.
I'm glad you clarified that, Rebecca.
Well, I saw that NMES was listed on here as a treatment option. And do you use that a lot with this population, or?
No, I don't. I'll tell you the group I use it on. I guess that's probably another bias. I resisted NMES training for a very long time. I didn't do it until maybe, I think, 5 years ago, y'all. I finally got vital stem done. And then I'm not going to say what I think about some of that. And then
This is uncensored. This is
uncensored. Uncensored. Well, let me just say, when I took the class, that I was spouting the literature from the back of the classroom when they would try to say some things, because I was like, no, that's not what it says. So maybe you didn't want me in that class. But anyway, then I took AMP Care's course about 3 years ago, and so this is the group I find. Okay, if there's no prevertebral swelling. Because this does happen. You have a cervical spinal cord injury patient and you have an elderly patient with sarcopenia, and they are going to be in the neck collar for 12 weeks and can't do any of our exercises. I'll consider it in that group.
Okay.
If they meet all the other, like if the swallow study shows it. I'm also kind of unusual. When I do an instrumental swallow study and I'm thinking about using NMES, I actually like to put the NMES on the patient for the swallow study and then see, does it actually help or not help? Because then the patient is like their own case study, is because it might be helpful to one, not to the other.
No, I think that's brilliant. Absolutely. Because that's like brilliant. We tell people to do the chin tuck on video, or otherwise, how do you know it works? Because in some people it like increases the aspiration rather than, you know, stop it. So why wouldn't you use NMES on, like, if you're doing imaging to make sure it works too?
Yeah, it's great. And then the other group I will use it on, and it's kind of a Hail Mary, and it has been a Hail Mary that has helped out a few people, is the group with a co-occurring brainstem stroke with the spinal cord injury. Another group that really can't do our exercises the way you need to do them in order for them to potentially be beneficial. I've used it in that group one of them, it was no. A couple of them, it helped. Do I think it was, you know, neuro recovery versus it could have been both. I will say this for those people who do NMES. If your patient is a C1 Asia A and they cannot feel below their chin, don't do NMES with them, please. Because they can't feel the electrodes. I don't care if you take them to the highest setting known to man. There's no peripheral sensation. You are not doing anything. And they will tell you they feel nothing. That should be your first warning sign that that is not a modality that's going to work in that particular situation. Just throwing that out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Because I see all the time in forums, people are like, my patient is status post blah, 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 ACDF. What are you thinking? And some people comment, you know, NMES, and other people say different things. And I'm always like, so patient dependent, and like how far out they are post-op and all that stuff.
There's a lot of variables with this group. And then also taking in the fact that, are they pretty obese? Are the electrodes even going to work in that sense too? Yeah, there's a lot going on there. And I find if they have the trach and you're trying to squeeze all that in a very small space, and then you have to put the cervical collar back on, and then it's just kind of a, it's a lot going on. I'm not certain often how therapeutic it is for them, but.
Well, Michelle, this was amazing. This was like such a great, like intro into your brain and how you like make decisions and your like how you approach things and like what's worked in your practice for this population. Like that is really, really helpful. I love the slideshow that you've made that we'll have up in the show notes, so people can kind of go back and see where you pulled this information so that they can go and take a look at it too.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was really great. Thank you so much.
I'm glad.
It was so good. And I love how you think about the entire picture and that you touched on so many different things that all can contribute to swallowing
outcomes. I'm over here like taking notes. I'm like, Michelle recommends watch the ACDF YouTube video.
I took a note.
Oh, what else did I write? Positioning is key. Like, please get them at neutral. Learn the Asia scoring system. And it's okay not to have a passenger valve on before doing food trials. I'm going to put this all up in the show notes. I'm so excited.
Yay. Great.
Thanks for listening to the Speech Uncensored podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes on speechuncensored.com. We have Michelle Dagon's slides from this presentation up on the website for you to download and review at your leisure. And if you could post a thoughtful review on Apple Podcasts so other SLPs can find the podcast and join us. I'm so excited to announce the launch of the Development Council for Speech Uncensored. The Development Council is made up of dedicated SLPs who want to contribute to the field in the delivery of podcast episodes, resources on the website, and community building. Stay tuned for some really awesome projects that they've got in the works coming out here pretty soon. And I want to give a big, big thanks to my brilliant audio editor, Laura Miller, for her rockstar editing skills. You are deeply appreciated, Laura. And I'm so glad that you, the listener, have decided to spend some of your time with us today. And I hope the material that we've covered has nourished your mind so that your practice can flourish. Now get out there and be awesome.